Welcome to Amnesty International's comedy podcast series. This year, Amnesty's had exclusive backstage access at two of the biggest events on the comedy calendar, the 2014 Edinburgh Festival Fringe and the Balham Comedy Festival in London. We'll be bringing you a series of interviews with some of the greatest stand-up comedians working today, and along with finding out about the business of laughter, we'll be chatting about life, politics, and human rights. On today's episode, we're joined by comedian and Radio 4 regular Jeremy Hardy. He talks about Twitter, politics, and the lies that his grandmother told him.
Welcome, Jeremy Hardy. Thanks so much for speaking to Amnesty International at the Balham Comedy Festival. And I just heard that you had your first ever show at Balham. Is that right?
Yes, my first circuit gig, my first open spot on the circuit was 30 years ago in January this year.
Wow.
In the big room downstairs.
Wow. And why is it a special place for comedians to come to, do you
think? It's been going a while now. It was started by Paul Merton and a friend of his called Andy Waring in 1983. And it's been going ever since. And I don't do many gigs here, but I do the Balham Comedy Festival because I'm local. So I haven't got far to come from Streatham.
And you recently played at Glastonbury, is that right?
Yes.
And then you're going to be at Latitude.
I'll be at Latitude.
And how is it being at a festival kind of compared to other venues like here or even other festivals like Edinburgh?
Slightly different. Well, I don't do Edinburgh because it's basically become a trade fair. So I'll go to Edinburgh in the autumn when everyone's left and do a gig then. But festivals all got their own character and their own dynamic, and you go on at weird times of day in a tent in daylight, you know, and so they can be quite strange, and sometimes they only want half an hour, and sometimes they want 40 minutes, and sometimes they want an hour, and then this is an hour, this one, because normally my shows are 2 hours long, so my audience is normally completely exhausted by the time I've finished. I've completely broken them, whereas these people just got an hour, so they're quite fresh, and then they can go and watch Kevin Day now that I've finished.
And was it a good experience in Glastonbury?
It was. It was good this year, yeah. Some years it's a bit rocky because you never quite know, because you know, people are bimbling around, and if it rains, a lot of people just suddenly run into the tent to dry off, and they're not really listening. And then it depends what's going on the other stages if some huge racket starts up. But now that I think I've found my crowd now at Glastonbury, they sort of know that I'm there. And then there's a few newcomers who I hopefully recruit to be my dwindling band of loyal followers.
And you are super active on Twitter.
Am I?
Well, from what I've been reading,
oh, okay.
Yes.
Oh,
and but would you say social media has changed your routine much at all, or is it giving you extra material?
In terms of what I do on Twitter, well, it's another reference point, I suppose. News, people are more. Are better informed, partly because of rolling news and partly because of social media. So, like, things are on Twitter before they're actually on the news, you know. So, you know, the headlines are sort of made on Twitter. And then there are different dynamics. I mean, you get these sort of Twitter campaigns and Twitter outrage, and it's another means by which it's a sort of bush telegraph where things spread very quickly. So, you know, the dynamics of how people feel about things are quite, you know, are much more rapid now. You know, you get a sense of what the feeling about something is quite rapid. You get a sense of a public opinion, really, because of things like Twitter. Facebook I don't do because it's mostly people talking about how clever their children are. But, but yeah, no, it's interesting in that way, Twitter. I mean, I suppose it can be a bit disposable because people think, oh, I've retweeted that petition. I've done my bit now. I've done my politics for the day. But you know, it means that the word is spreading very quickly, and if someone says something loathsome on the news, then people are immediately responding to it very quickly, and so it is quite it speeded things up, you know.
I'd say you obviously don't hold back on your political comedy at all, and your show, you know, this evening was completely bursting with topical issues. When you started out in comedy, did you purposefully think, oh, I'm going to use my routines to raise awareness, you know, like this week's events in Gaza, or has that just evolved over time?
That evolved over time. Initially, I thought I wasn't that political, but I think it was at a time when I felt Thatcherism was so rampant in 1984, 85, and I just felt like you know, the left was collapsing and the miners lost, and you just felt like almost a responsibility because you've got a platform. It might be a bit vainglorious, but you think, well, I'm actually on stage and people are listening. And I actually felt like I should make an effort to say things. The trouble is how you make things entertaining. I mean, if we just make a speech, then it's not entertaining, or it can be entertaining, but it's not humour. So, I mean, to be honest, I found the whole Gaza situation so upsetting. I'm kind of at a loss to say anything about it other than reference here. But, you know, and you, the danger is that you actually diminish the thing by reducing it to a one-liner, that in a way you're almost dishonouring the horror of something by just sort of trying to turn it into a quip. So it's a tricky one, that. But, yeah, I mean, those things do motivate me.
Yeah, and would you say that's one of the things you enjoy most about your job?
Yeah, I suppose it's satisfying to get across an idea, to have, you know, and people say, oh, you're preaching to the converted, everyone agrees with you. You think, well, that's fine, and I hope that they do. I mean, I'd be mortified if I thought that nobody else agreed with me. I'm not out there on a mission to convert. I prefer to think that I'm rallying the troops, you know, that people, I'm cheering people up, and that they're feeling, well, that's good, somebody's on stage saying what I think. But if I, you know, I mean, I think it's unlikely that I would change someone's mind through jokes, but I suppose you just add to the general culture of you know, what I hope are progressive and enlightened ideas. You add to that climate, that atmosphere.
Because you just mentioned in your show that you're slightly less political than you used to be because of that worry of, you know, can you actually change anything? Does it change anything? But
yeah,
do you really believe that?
I'm not as active as I used to be, probably, because you do just get demoralised. You know, I should be doing more, you know, but I sort of think, oh, you know, well, let the young people do it. I mean, I do stuff and I do lots of benefits and I go on demonstrations and stuff, but there is that danger that you sort of think, well, maybe I should be looking at my own happiness. You know, I haven't got that much longer to live. I'm in the back half now, I'm 53. Maybe I should just be thinking about my future and worrying about, well, how I'm going to live when I'm old. So there is that danger and as I say, you can't just think that because you've retweeted something on Twitter that that's a serious political act. You know, that's just exchanging information. But I think it is a danger that you feel, you know, you feel powerless. You feel like, you know, I've been around a long time. Things don't seem to have got any better, you know. And that's, you know, a lot of people get less active.
Which comedians from the circuit at the moment would you say you really like or respect?
Oh, there's loads of great comics out there. I mean, Mark Steele's brilliant. Daniel Kitson's brilliant. Jen Brister, Francesca Martinez, Elliot Steele, who's Mark Steele's 17-year-old son, who's a brilliant comic in his own right. There's loads of people. Shappy Khorsandi's great. There's you know, Josie Long and people of my lot, like, you know, Kevin Day and Mark Thomas and Joe Brand. And
it's just one or two.
There's tons of great people out there. And, you know, somebody like Jack D, I think, is a good friend and a very funny comic. He might not be political particularly, but he's a great comic. Because, I mean, I am a comic and I like good comedy. And if I go out to watch something, sometimes I just want to laugh and not think about the horrors of the world.
So just on the horrors of the world, the Conservatives have talked about scrapping the Human Rights Act.
Yeah.
I imagine you've got some strong opinions about that.
Well, somehow the Conservatives have managed to convince everybody that the Human Rights Act is something foisted upon us by the European Union, whereas, of course, it all comes from the Second World War. You know, the idea that human rights must be enshrined in law, so that something like the Holocaust, facile though it sounds, needs to be made clear that deliberate and massive atrocities against civilian populations are not acceptable, and that maybe we could get states to follow international law, and in this country, of course, we don't even have a written constitution, we don't even have a Bill of Rights, so it's very important that people can't just be abducted in the middle of the night and have a bag put on their head and flown to torture centre, you know, on Diego Garcia. It's important that we have these rights. Mm. And people think, oh, it's all to do with criminals getting away with it, or the police having to deliver pizzas to prisons or something. And it's none of that stuff. You know, it's about, you know, human beings having rights enshrined in law, and states being badgered into having these. And, you know, and modern states like Britain and America are actually you know, rolling forward the repression of the state against the population in terms of surveillance, in terms of the massive spying operations, and anybody who blows a whistle about that, is in trouble. So I think it's more important than ever, you know, because everyone assumes, oh well, our politicians are all sleek and young and nice, and you know, we don't have to worry about tyranny. But you have to always worry about tyranny, even if your society appears to be a very benign and civilized and modern one.
And if you were in power for one day, have you got any laws you would change or repeal or impose?
If I were in power for a day, I would immediately bring in a massively complex Bill of Rights to stop me from doing the things that I would do if I were in power. Because I think that's the thing about power, it needs to be restrained, because there's all things that we would do if we had power, but that doesn't mean that we should do those things. You know, I'm quite a vengeful person. I'd be like Strelnikov in Dr. Zhivago. All sorts of people would be jailed if I were in power. And that, of course, isn't how things should be. So I would seek to have as little political power as possible. But I would renationalise the railways.
The lovely railways. And Amnesty International has just launched a global Stop Torture campaign. We've had reports of torture in 141 countries, two-thirds of all countries in the world. Does it surprise you that it's so prevalent?
Well, when you think that this country is implicated in torture, it's not surprising at all that basically, you know, MI6 have interviewed people who've been tortured by the Americans or their proxies. I mean, it's no surprise at all. Israel practices torture and is part of the Western Alliance and is in the Eurovision Song Contest. And it's just considered rendition or heightened interrogation now. So no, I'm not at all surprised.
Because around a third of people said that they thought torture was justified in certain situations. This is on a survey Amnesty did.
Well, there's obviously, I mean, the war on terror has sort of played a blinder in making people think that we are under constant threat, despite the fact that, you know, our society is much safer than it used to be. In Victorian London, you couldn't walk around Oxford Street at night. You'd be murdered. You'd be attacked. And rich people had sword sticks so that they could stab muggers. You know, I mean, the idea that we live in this terrifying world and there are all these terrorists who are going to blow us up on. But very few people are terrorists. It's quite an unpopular hobby. But of course, it's useful for the state, for us all to be terrified. So the state can protect us from all these unknown lurking dangers out there. And so people think, well, you know, if it gets useful information. And there are misleading films, you know, like the suggestion that Osama bin Laden was caught because of torture. That's not true. Torture is a very unreliable way of extracting information. If you torture someone, they will tell you whatever stops you from torturing them. It is an utterly useless way of getting information out of people. There are far more benign, humane methods of interrogation which are much more effective.
And then on a much lighter note, we were just wondering, could you tell us what your favourite story from grandma was?
My favourite story from my grandma? My grandma Becky, my mother's mother, was a liar. She made up she told us that we were descended from Sir Christopher Wren, which is entirely possible, but apparently only because he used to shag all his workmen's wives while they were working for him. So most people in the country are descended from him. She told us that her grandfather was a Welsh coal miner because his name was Jones, and therefore he must have been Welsh, and therefore he must have been a coal miner. She told us that her other grandfather, her father was a close confidant of the king and a royal protection officer because he was a copper on duty in Westminster, and they would have had to do royal protection during sort of parades and things like that.
Wow.
She also told us that she had a grandfather who had a huge estate in Kent from which he was tricked out of this estate. Basically the subplot of Bleak House. She convinced us that we were descended from this aristocrat in Kent. And tracing him through family history, it turns out he was a dredgerman on the Isle of Sheppey who made a living getting dead bodies out of the river and being given money for and catching a few oysters.
You're all a bit disappointed by that.
Yes, so my ancestry is incredibly, incredibly lacklustre.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, that's been lovely. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks a lot.
If you're interested in learning more about human rights or joining Amnesty International, then please go to our website, amnesty.org.uk, and make sure you don't miss our next episode. Here's a sneak peek.
It's great as a comic when you enjoy doing a routine rather than just sort of feel like you're going through it. I still have moments in it where I'll just chuck in a couple of extra bits that I didn't even necessarily know that I'd thought of at the time, but they just come to my head. Because I think you spend years trying to find your voice, and then when you do, don't be afraid to use it.